Hi, I'm Avery Elfelt, a reporter with the Alaska Desk. That's a joint reporting effort from Alaska Public Media, KHNS, where I work in Haines, and other public radio stations in Anchorage, Fairbanks, and the Aleutians. It allows us to connect you with the issues happening in communities all across the state. You can hear our stories during the morning news on Alaska News Nightly or online at alaskapublic.org. The Alaska Desk is only possible with the support of grants and listeners like you. Thank you.
Welcome to Outdoor Explorer. I'm your host, Paul Torta. Snow is on the mountains, and that means it's time to think about recreating safely in avalanche terrain. There are many avenues to learn about avalanches and what causes them, how to assess slopes for stability, how to travel through avalanche terrain, and how to perform rescues. One recent addition is guide and educator Joe Stock's book, The Avalanche Factor. Last spring, I sat down with Joe to discuss his book, including topics like decision-making in a group, science and uncertainty, the roles risk and fear playing in decision-making, how to develop knowledge and judgment while staying safe, and more. Stay tuned for Outdoor Explorer. Welcome back to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Paul Tordock, and today I have my great pleasure to have Joe Stock in the studio with me. Joe is the author of The Avalanche Factor and a couple books. Welcome to the show, Joe.
Oh, thanks. It's great to be here with you, Paul.
Yeah, finally. It's been a while. We've talked about this, and I'm really happy to have you here. We're recording this in early summer, but we'll be talking a lot about winter. So tell us a bit about yourself and what influenced you to get to writing books about avalanches and the outdoors.
Oh, yeah. Well, I grew up in Eastern Washington. My parents were both professors, and they did a lot of outdoor stuff until when they had me, and then they got involved with their career and raising me. And then when I was about 12 years old, I started getting quite interested in the outdoors, more than just backpacking with them. I wanted to go climbing and skiing in the backcountry. So Dad and I took kind of the courses and kind of learned together, and we started doing a lot of stuff together from there. And one of the things that got us going is he had a group of graduate students in mechanical engineering at Washington State University, and they were a really gung-ho group of graduate students that would go off backcountry skiing on the weekends. And so we went with them and did hut trips or yurt trips there in the Wallowa Mountains and North Idaho and such. And so started going with them. And there's also the Washington State University Alpine Club who was kind enough to let a young kid go on all their trips with them, you know, and that didn't cost any money. I just joined them, and they, sort of looked after me, but they let me come along, which is what mattered.
Well, that's excellent. As a 12-year-old.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I think it was great. Yeah, because my parents were working a lot then, so I remember my dad packing my backpack up for me and sending me off, to Mount Rainier when I was in seventh grade with the Alpine Club, and, you know, they weren't... they just kind of treated me like any college students. They kind of watched after me a little bit, but I had the time of my life.
And your parents weren't along on these trips?
They were when they had, my dad was along when he had time, but, you know, they were working a lot.
Yeah.
So they, he always wanted to. And we, then, you know, as their careers went on, dad had more time. So we started going on more and more trips together.
Sounds like they were the anti-helicopter parents. They're more like the get out of the door parents and leave us alone.
Yeah, exactly. Get the moping teenager out of the house because he'll drive us crazy if he's around here. So kick him out and make him go climbing on the weekend. That's definitely the way. And they definitely encouraged it a lot. You know, they knew what the mountains were about and they thought they were a good thing. And so they were very encouraging for me to go off and learn the stuff and be in the mountains. And yeah.
Now, you write in your book about you saw an avalanche when you were age 12, and that really got you interested in this. Is that really true? Is that what happened?
Yeah. That first trip, I still remember it quite vividly. When I was 12 years old, we went into the Wallowas, into McCully Basin, which that operation is still going now. Different owner. It was the original owner then. And we stayed in the yurts and we skied around. I mean that was a long time ago. So we had little wooden skis and little tennis shoes sort of ski boots.
Yeah.
So we were on really low angle slopes, but, you know, making telemark turns and having the time of our life. And I just remember we were, you know, with that kind of equipment, we weren't going up and skiing off the mountaintops at all. So we were down low in the trees and it snowed a lot. And I remember hearing that the rumble from the mountains above and them dad telling me it was an avalanche. And then I remember did my first avalanche project in sixth grade. And that was like a poster on, you know, avalanche safety. And, you know, one of them was like had slope. I had like four things on there. One of them was like slope angle. Another one was just picking a safe route. And it showed like staying in the steep forest. And there was an open steep slope. And it said never across there. You know, never go out there. You know, it was very much the attitude of the day. But now that's where I want to be more than anywhere else.
Right. Yeah. In many ways, we avoid trees, you know, sometimes.
Yeah.
I love tree skiing, but still,
right.
You know. And so from there, what did you do? Like, you went to college? Like, what was your path from there?
Yeah. Well, because I grew up in kind of an academic household, it was kind of naturally thought I was going to go to college. And so I started off in geology at Montana State. And, you know, there's too much distractions around there. I did get A+s in skiing and ice climbing and things like that. But I wanted to do better in school. So I ended up finishing there in at University of Canterbury in Christchurch, New Zealand.
Uh-huh.
And so that was great. And it was, you know, a three-year British program. So, you know, I loved it. And so I started in geology, then switched over to physical geography, more earth surface processes. And, you know, I started off being more interested in glaciers. I went up to the Juneau Icefield Research Program
as
a high school student. That was really transformative.
Yeah.
And so I thought, oh, glaciers are really cool. Then I started realizing about snow science through Montana State when I was there. I did an internship there with Carl Berkland, and that was really a life changer.
Huh.
And I realized that avalanches move faster and more... a little bit more interesting and dynamic. And,
slow-moving glacier.
Yeah, then a slow-moving glacier, yeah.
Uh-huh.
So went to University of Canterbury and then finished there and then came back and went for a master's in watershed science at Colorado State.
Oh,
and, you know, studying snow as part of that, but also learned a lot about water. Water on the Earth's surface, which is really cool.
You really dive deep into it.
Yeah, it was really interesting.
Back then. And then how'd you end up in Alaska?
Well, I'd been coming up here, you know, starting with the Juneau Icefield Research Program in high school, and then came up working in fish processing plants, and then started mountain guiding in my early 20s and would come up here for summers guiding like on Denali and the Wrangell St. Elias and stuff. And then Kathy and I decided we'd try it out one winter in 2002, and we've been here since. After a month of being in Anchorage, I knew it was the place.
And why? Why Anchorage?
Oh, just like Anchorage. Yeah, it was, you know, it's not the most beautiful city, but it has just incredible people, and it's right on the edge of the wilderness of wild open mountains with nobody out there. And that was, I realized how special it is. And I absolutely love living in Anchorage.
Right. And currently you have all kinds of irons in the fire. You're an author, you're a guide. How does that play out in your life?
It's not straightforward. It's like you live in that kind of, with that kind of career, it's kind of always hustling for work in a lot of ways, but, you know, part of what has really made it possible was going through the whole guide certification program. And that took me 11 years of, like, guiding and then taking the courses and taking the exams. And, you know, with each one of those exams, it was recognized, by other guide services and employers, and clients are ready to pay more for that. So it allowed me to make guiding, a career where I can pay a mortgage and have health care and stuff like that. But then it's also combining it with the writing. I've been interested in writing since my early 20s and just, you know, started off with like freelance writing for magazines, and that became more difficult with the After like 2009 economy collapse. And so I started shifting gears to other types of writing, like the books and writing online and stuff.
And the guide certification is with who?
It's the American Mountain Guides Association, yeah. And that's the U.S. branch of the International Federation of Mountain Guides Associations. Yeah. So in the U.S., U.S. is one of 27 member countries. And so I went through the whole program, the American Mountain Guides Association program, and that has three disciplines, ski, alpine, and rock. And alpine is the thing I was doing the most, and so I went through that first, and that's like guiding people up mountains like in the Cascades. So yeah. It's a lot of just taking like the examiners who are like, you know, examiner, like they're really qualified guides and climbers like Martin Vulcan and Steve House, and guiding them up peaks day after day. So, and if you can do it and you keep them safe and show you know what you're doing, then you pass. So did that first, and then, but that kind of left a bad, I did pass. I was one of two people that year to pass in, I think it's 2003. I did get through that exam, but it kind of left a really sour taste in my mouth.
Interesting.
Yeah, because they failed almost everybody. And I was just like, well, is this really what guiding's all about? So I went and did more writing and hydrology work.
Yeah.
For a couple years, and then, you know, I love the field work and love the writing, love the hydrology field work, but sitting in the office, looking out the window at the mountains drove me crazy. Yeah. So that renewed my interest in guiding. And then I finished up the ski certification. And that was started in the Ruby Mountains in Nevada. And then took a couple more courses and exam in Valdez. And then rock and rock climbing. I've been rock climbing my whole life. But that's probably my weakest aspect. So I spent two summers working for Colorado Mountain School in Estes Park in Boulder, Colorado.
Good place to go climbing.
Yeah. It was incredible. Yeah, I felt so lucky. So I'd like guide during the day, and then in the evening I could go climbing with the other guides. And then if I got a day free, go do routes with these really real rock jocks. And those exams were, well, the courses were like around Boulder, like in El Dorado Canyon, which is an incredible place to learn skills, like really hard leading, a difficult gear. But then the two exams were in Red Rocks.
Oh.
So it's just guiding those big routes every day.
Yeah, nice.
Yeah.
And I imagine you're one of the few people, Alaskans, that have all three of those. It's not very common.
Yeah, well, now there have been others that have kind of gotten it and then not working as much as guides. Well, like Jamie Pierce down in Juneau, he was doing that. And there's some others, but Elliot Gaddy just got his. He's a guide here in Anchorage, got his a year ago. So that's exciting to have him also fully certified.
Oh, that's really impressive, Joe. So, you know, we're here to sort of talk about decision-making and outdoors. You've got a book, The Avalanche Factor, out. You have another book of The Alaska Factor, more of a guidebook. You've done a lot of writing. So I really want, you know, us to share your knowledge of what, you know, you've sort of been thinking about when it comes to decision-making in the outdoors, sort of using avalanches as sort of a metaphor, real and otherwise, for the outdoors. I sort of want to start off with you talk about sort of decision making in your book, and specifically sort of planning. So we're going on trips, and this could be winter or otherwise. So let's start with that first step, because I'm thinking about a trip, and how do you go about planning a trip? How do you recommend people, like, what factors to go into planning a trip to make it? And we're talking about a successful trip, let's start with that. What's a successful trip to you?
Well, a successful trip, people have different definitions. And I guess the classic definition is, did you get to the summit or not? But it's like, if you have that attitude, you're not going to climb any mountains or go on many trips. But yeah. So a successful trip is where you come back in one piece and there weren't close calls or accidents, and you haven't frostbite in your fingers, and you've had a good time with your with your friends that you're out there with.
That's excellent. Yeah. So that's good. I agree. So let's talk about planning. What's that first step to make that happen?
Well, yeah, the first step is, it's kind of working up to it. Like if you want to do, like, let's say a trip into remote Alaska, it's like, well, you're not going to drive up here from Mississippi and go right into there. You're going to work up to it. So let's say, so you need to get the training, you know, you need to learn the skills. And, with avalanches, most people take these, avalanche courses, like a rec level one, avalanche course and a rescue course. So, or if you're going to go mountaineering, you learn the baseline skills, and those are a little more straightforward, so you can learn those on your own from friends or stuff. But you know, it's always best to learn from a qualified professional to learn the baseline standards. So you get the base skills, and then gaining experience. So it's kind of like ramping up to this big trip. So yeah. It's like. Let's say if you want to go on this trip in remote Alaska, you're going to do trip in smaller mountains or on the, you know, closer to the road, smaller trips, and then like ease into it. So it's bigger and bigger and bigger. So when you do go on to a big trip in a more remote place, you have a solid foundation of skills and experience and practice there to rely on.
Mm-hmm. What else about planning? What about like equipment and, you know, like putting all that stuff together?
Yeah, equipment. I mean, that's what I'm going to be doing tomorrow because I'm getting ready to go on a week-long trip starting Saturday. So I'm going to be dealing with all the equipment. And, you know, initially that's really a focus of, you know, what equipment are you going to take and what works and everything like that. And that's, there is a lot to it, but then it's one of these things you can kind of figure out after a while. It's like what works and what doesn't work. And it's like you can hold on to this equipment and try it out. And it's like, well, you know, this jacket doesn't work. It leaks. So I'm going to get a different jacket. Or this ice tool is like doesn't go into the ice very well. So I'm not going to use that one. I'm going to get this other one. It's like, wow, this ice tool really works. So I really like this one. So it's like, you know, testing out using all your equipment and practicing with it, you know, like you know, one of these things you really have to practice with a lot is like the avalanche transceiver, and just wearing one's not going to work. And similarly, crevasse rescue. It's like just having that equipment doesn't mean you're not going to fall in a hole or know how to use it. So you have to go out there and deliberately practice with that equipment. So, go on practicing avalanche rescue every day, going before a trip and practicing with the ropes and the haul systems and making ski anchors for attaching the haul systems for doing a crevasse rescue and things like that. It's all these skills we need to practice that are take a little bit of diligence.
Yeah. Yeah. You are listening to Outdoor Explorer in Alaska Public Media. I'm Joe Stock talking about his writing and experience as a guide. And Joe, I like that practice. Yesterday, I bought a little personal locator beacon for a boat I have, and I'm like, I want to practice with it, right? First, I read instructions to find out so I wouldn't call in a rescue while I was practicing, but it's just that, you know, in music, there's a saying, you know, practice perfect, right? So you want to always practice like it's the real thing.
You're right.
And I think that's, so I did, I pulled it out, like, okay we're going to like practice like we're using this thing, and And it was good because it wasn't obvious when I used it.
Yeah.
How to use it. I wouldn't want to be trying to figure it out in an emergency.
Right, yeah. Some people think that it's like they can figure out like how to do a crevasse rescue haul system, but it's like, well, it's actually not intuitive. Right. And the real situation is really, really difficult.
Yeah, even using a radio, it's better learn how to press the talk button.
Yeah, exactly.
Make it talk.
Yeah, but so, doing it in repetition, hopefully under a stressful situation during your practice.
What I'm sort of curious, want to talk a lot about risk and sort of decision making as we go along here, but when we're so I think about equipment. Do you think, and you mentioned growing up, you know, skiing on single leather boots, and some of the photos in your book I could relate to. They're like old wooden double camber skis with no metal edges,
yeah.
And we didn't ski hard stuff then,
right?
Because our probably our skill level wasn't as good, but also the equipment was good.
Right.
Do you think equipment has increased our sort of risk tolerance?
Oh, yeah, that's a great question. Yeah, I don't think the new equipment allows us to have any more fun. I definitely think I was having just as much fun on those little skinny teleskis and little leather boots. But in terms of, it does allow us to get into much more dangerous situations where it's like, you know, now the norm, you know, backcountry skiing, not the norm, but a lot of people strive to get into this big, steep avalanche terrain, you know, the avalanche terrain, like, you know, over 30 degrees, and the equipment allows us to do that because you ski at the ski resort, and it's like, well, go into the backcountry, and that's easy skiing, but it's like, well, that's where the avalanches happen, so it's much more difficult, and like, yeah, just all this modes of travel allows us to get in trouble a lot easier.
And how do you teach people, guide people, to sort of take that into effect? Like when they're planning a trip, but right now we're talking about planning trips. So I just went out and I just spent, let's say I dropped $2,000 on all this equipment.
Yeah.
I dropped probably, you know, half that much on a course.
Uh-huh.
So I'm like, okay, and I've been in the gym. I'm a little fit, so I've spent some money on the gym. And I've put time, effort, and money into this. And now I'm gonna go do something.
Yeah.
Right? So how do you temper that sort of motivation to go at it,
yeah.
Get it, you know?
Yeah, the enthusiasm to get out there and do it.
Right.
Yeah, because you're kind of seeing everybody else do it, and they're like, well, that's what I should be doing. I should be getting out there and climbing these hard routes, or I should be skiing this steep phase like everybody else does. But, I mean, it takes it requires, like, to do it in a sustainable manner, it takes, like, a slow progression to build up that stable platform of experience and skills so you don't get in over your head. So you do have like a mental database of what works and what doesn't work and how you can get yourself in trouble. So just going slowly and thinking, you know, I just listened to a podcast with the climber Graham Zimmerman, and he talked about having the 100-year plan. And I thought that was a great way of putting it where, you know, it's like if you go slow and build up this strong base of experience and just like slowly notch it up slowly, then you're less likely to get an accident. And if you're alive, you're going to get a lot more climbing in than if you're dead.
Yeah.
So
or
just
hurt.
Hurt.
Really.
Yeah.
Know, yeah.
Yeah. So just going slow so you don't get hurt. Don't get it over your head like, you know, like ice climbing. Let's say that you're not going to get up there over your head and take a 50-footer on an ice climb and smash up your ankle. So when you do get up there on the big steep ice, it's like, okay, you know what you're doing. You're in control. It's hard, but you're in control.
So elaborate on the go slow, because I always said, saying you go slow to go fast. When we think about slow, sometimes we think about the actual pace of your thing, but I think it means more than that.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's a real, it's kind of an overarching principle, is this going slow. And that's a lot of the beauty of, you know, not having machines involved with a lot of this. You know, I mean, I do use a car to drive around and helicopters, I mean, unless I can avoid them, and then, you know, airplanes and stuff. So, but in general, it's like I'm walking and I'm walking uphill on skis or whatever, and that allows us to go slow. So and then there's also that pace during the day without machines. There's also slow, like we were just talking about there, like a slow progression of skills, like not rushing into something and getting it over your head. And then there's also like going slow just for decision making, because it's slowing down is like a known way to improve decisions. So it gives yourself time to think. And so it's like, you know, I realized this maybe 10 years ago, you know, out skiing with my guide buddies. And then I kept on coming back with all these photos of just of my guide buddies just standing there looking out into the valley or looking up the slope. And they're just standing there. And I had so many photos of them just standing there. And it's like, and, you know, less experienced people, I never had any photos like that. But guides just like stand there and look, because it's like they're taking in this this complex environment, and there's like so much going on out there. You know, it's like we think there's a lot going on in our cell phones and in our computers and at work and everything, but I mean, compared to nature, it's like it seems like there's way more going on in nature. And just going out there, it takes us, takes slowing down to let it soak it in, let that information soak in. Because, you know, we come, most of us like live in a house and sleep in a bed and drive in a car. So we are kind of detached from nature a bit. So when we get out there, we'd need to let that information from nature kind of soak in, like, you know, what's the distribution of the snow? How's the wind blowing? Are the rocks falling today? Are the seracs dangerous? All these things. There's so much going on there. You know, millions and millions of things. So it's like taking that all in.
Yeah, and I think social media also plays into that factor a little bit of us, like you said, everybody else is doing it. You know, fear of missing out, whatever you want to call it. You want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. I'm so extremely susceptible to FOMO, fear of missing out, that I can't deal with social media. I mean, it's like Facebook, Instagram. I've really tried a couple times, but it's just like the FOMO kills me. I don't want to know what other people are doing because I want to be doing it.
Yeah.
So I can't, you know, it's like ski movies. I can't watch ski movies because it's
funny.
Yeah, it's like, well, I don't want to watch people do it. I want to do it.
Yeah, right.
And so it's, and I think it is real for people that it's like, you know, we hear about it to get this impression that everybody's skiing these faces and that's what everybody's doing. They should be doing it too. And you're going to be famous and happy and life's going to be complete if I'm doing what everybody else is. But you know, and it's, I think it's like, I'm not that into social media.
How, we have a few minutes before our break. What is your advice for people? Let's say I'm starting out and I want to gain experience and I want to gain, be able to make decisions. So I've taken a course, I've got the equipment, I've maybe done the educational thing, but I want to set out on my own. What's your advice? Let's talk about a backcountry skiing. I want to get into backcountry skiing, and I want to go someplace, do something with a couple friends. What's your advice? Maybe specifically a place to go, or just a general first step for people?
Yeah, a first step. For backcountry skiing, it's like, I mean, one of the main things you need to start with is the ability to move around. So skiing, and the hard part is known as ski or split board. So go to the ski resort and get good at skiing, get some lessons. So that's a non-issue. You don't want the skiing to be an issue in the backcountry. That's a thing that's often overlooked, because skiing in the backcountry is it just makes you a worse skier.
You
need to go to the ski resort, get the vertical, and ski on bad resort snow, and that makes you a really good skier. So you got to have that foundation, and then, like you said, take the course, like the avalanche courses. And also, you know, what's good is to take like an intro to backcountry skiing course, just to learn how to, you know, trip plan, how to use the gear, and how to look at the mountains and set like a good skin track. That's another big aspect. It's because you spend most of your day is going uphill, and there's a real art to it. Yeah. Nobody cares about your down track, but other people do care about your skin track. So you need to learn how to do that. And then, in a lot of ways, I just think just go for it. But, you know, have the biggest life-saving tool out there, and my absolute favorite thing is to just be ready to turn around. Just be ready to turn around. Because if you have that ability to turn around, if you've practiced turning around and have a strong turning around muscle, then you're ready to use that skill. And so you can always go for it because you know you have the ability to turn around. And you have to practice that. And just get used and be proud of yourself turning around.
That's excellent advice. You are listening to Outdoor Explorer in Alaska Public Media. I have Joe Stock, author of The Avalanche Factor, with me. We'll be right back after this break.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes store or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Outdoor Explorer. I'm your host, Paul Tordak. We are talking with Joe Stock, author of The Avalanche Factor and Mountain Guide. Joe, let's talk about writing for a minute. You've been a really prolific writer and continue to do so. What do you like about writing?
Oh, writing, yeah. I love the challenge of writing. It's just like, it's so difficult. And it's, I mean, if people think it's not difficult, then they've never written before. Because just putting together sentences together and trying to express what you're feeling, and it's just a great way to learn. And, you know, I started writing, like, when in college and writing about trips I was going on and those experiences and trying to learn more from those trips and writing for, like, the magazines like Rock and Ice and Backcountry Magazine and Alaska Magazine and stuff. But more recently, it's been more about, like, technique and mountain skills.
Yeah.
And, you know, I like writing. And actually, the writing I've been doing lately, you know, in addition to the guidebooks, is these articles for, like, the Avalanche Review, which is the publication for avalanche professionals in the United States.
Yeah.
And it's not paid at all. But what I'm doing with those articles is I'm finding, like, gaps in my knowledge and then gaps in the literature. And then it's just like, oh, I can just, as a way to learn about these topics, I can write an article. And so that gives me a deadline and stuff like that. So I've really enjoyed doing that. Like last winter, I did some really fun articles, one on luck in avalanches, and nothing had been written on that. And then I wrote about an avalanche uncertainty scale. So I got to learn more about uncertainty, one of my favorite topics. And this winter, I wrote an article about avalanche writing in general, just like some general principles for avalanche writing. And that was a lot of fun because I couldn't find any articles in that. And then this winter, our article I'm working on is these crossover principles between science and avoiding avalanches. Because I haven't been able to find anything written on that before. So that's been a lot of fun. I'm learning a huge amount, all these similarities between science and avoiding avalanches. Like, you know, these concepts like uncertainty, you know, how uncertainty drives science, and there's always this inherent uncertainty. Same thing with avalanches, and then how there is, you know, in science, you got to acknowledge that there's no such thing as the truth, but we're just trying to get closer to the truth. Just like with avalanches, we don't know, and there's also like consensus and falsifying and using a method.
What's like falsifying?
Well, one of these real famous people in science, Karl Popper, wrote about, you know, made famous about to be science, it has to be falsifiable. And so how do I translate that over to avoiding avalanches? You have to be able to, because you can't prove anything's true, but you can't
prove it,
you can't prove it, but you can disprove it, like you can prove it false. So, like in avalanches, applying that to avalanche safety, you know, when we go out there, you know, we do a trip plan and we're like, oh, it's going to be, it looks all, it's low danger, all the observations, so it's low danger. So, I think we can do this trip into some complex terrain. But while we're out there, we're not trying to prove it's stable and not going to avalanche. We're doing the opposite. We're falsifying that. So we're trying to find unstable snow.
Right.
It's a search for unstable snow. We're searching for red flags. We're doing tests to try to find that unstable snow to prove it's not stable.
Huh, interesting.
Yeah.
So the idea being, just because you find a stable snow pit doesn't really mean much.
Right. Because it's like easy for us to find signs of stable snow because we're so good at applying confirmation bias to our decision making.
Right. Meaning that we want stable snow.
Yeah.
So therefore we find stable snow.
Yeah.
We're gonna see it. Right.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's a really tricky thing with the mind. Like a couple, you know, and we're all susceptible, and no matter how much experience you have, it's just like it's really a difficult thing to try to search for unstable snow. Like a couple of weeks ago, a buddy and I were up at Hatcher Pass going back to this area that I'd never been to before, and it was my second attempt to get back there, and we're going up the valley. The avalanche danger was low, And it was like, okay, sounds good. No observations of unstable snow. We start going up into the valley, and my buddy's like, I think I heard a whoomp. And then we start poking in with the ski poles, and it's like, oh, geez, there's a weak layer down there. Yeah. And then it was almost like, let's just forget about that and keep going. Yeah. So it was just because I wanted to ski in this remote corner of Hatcher Pass so bad. So we keep on going up the valley, and then I'm leading, and then all of a sudden I heard this big boom on the ridge I was on. I was like, oh shoot, I can't ignore that one. That was like a real whoomp. Yeah. So it's like I really need to hone in on those signs of unstable snow, and it's hard to do when you're motivated on getting the goal.
And so that I love the phrase in the first half, you taught the turnaround muscle.
Yeah.
So the turnaround muscle was flexed.
Yeah, yeah. So I was like I should have been quick to use that turnaround muscle a little earlier. Maybe my turnaround muscle is a little weak right then. But
but
I've already been, you know, with clients, you know, this winter, turning around a lot, you know, and the clients I go with, a lot of them every year, and they're just used to me turning around.
Yeah.
And it's just like, you know, this like Joe's kick turn, you're on the kick track, skin track, and going back down, they're used to it. And that's kind of, they know how it's
like. It's like you have two muscles in your brain, the turnaround muscle and the go for it muscle.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
And you kind of like, which one's stronger or weaker at any given point. Right?
Yeah, right, yeah. Right. And I've really had to work on that turnaround muscle because it's the other ones, you know, for climbers and skiers, we're so, so obsessed about, you know, getting these goals that, I mean, that's the easy part, skiing off these peaks and, you know, climbing and stuff, that's the easy part. Turning around is extremely difficult.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about decision making. I want to talk about, in your books, you talk about sort of the idea of risk and uncertainty. And I think that is really interesting to me, like how those play into, you know, enforcing that. Because risk, right, is for you, I think, maybe not for everybody, a part of the fun, right?
Right, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It's going out there and challenging yourself and putting yourself in these dangerous situations that where you do have to, you know, it's kind of, I don't really like the term much, but it kind of works by managing the risk, you know, trying to, you know, listen to what the mountain's telling you and acting accordingly.
Yeah.
So you can keep on doing this into a long, long age.
And how do you try to quantify that, the uncertainty and the risk? Because uncertainty really is one of the, probably a part of the formula of risk.
Like right,
not,
right.
Not knowing what, and risk we can define as sort of the chances and the consequences of something bad happening. And so uncertainty is a big part of that, right?
Right, right.
And how do you try to manage all that in your decision making?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, quantifying. I mean, you can't, I don't think, I don't know, I can't remember all my definitions now, but you can't quantify this because of the uncertainty component. So it's like, a lot of it's, you know, because I've been doing it so long, it's intuition. It's just like how I'm feeling. And it's like, you know, when it comes to, you know, just acknowledging, it's a hard thing to wrap our heads around, but there this uncertainty with the snowpack and in the mountains, you just don't know. And anybody that acts like they know or acts like they 100% know with the snowpack, you know, they don't know what they're talking about.
Right, yeah.
So, you know, one of these tools for dealing with uncertainty is like when I'm just wondering too much, I'm just like, well, what's the snow doing? I'm not sure. It's like, okay, that's a sign for turning around, in doubt, turning around, and just like getting used to like, I don't know why I'm not sure, but it's like I'm wondering too much and I'm thinking too much and I'm hemming and hawing in front of the group. Then it's just like, okay, that's a sign to switch directions.
That's an excellent trigger. I like that a lot. Like when you're can't make up your mind, maybe it's this time to bail out. Right.
Yeah, yeah. So I've used that. That kind of goes back to that turning around a lot, that just always being ready to use it, just in doubt. Don't have to have a reason, just turning around.
Yeah.
And because it is dangerous now. And the snowpack, when you're dealing with avalanches and snowpack, it's like you don't know what's going on inside the snow, but you have some idea, but you don't know for 100% sure. So it's there's a huge amount of uncertainty. And because you can make a bad decision and the snow doesn't tell you. I mean, it may not avalanche.
Yeah.
So you don't get that feedback. You know, they call it a poor feedback environment or a wicked learning environment is another term for it. It's kind of like the the opposite of like rock or sport climbing. Sport climbing, it's like a kind of learning environment. It's just like you go up there, you got bolts, you try a move, and it's like you fall off, and it's like, well, that didn't work. I'm going to try the move a different way. And it's like, oh, that worked. And so you instantly learn, and you get that feedback. So it's really, you know, it's easy to learn and easy to get better really quickly. But at avalanche skills, it's just like, well, you don't get that feedback. You go out there in like considerable danger day, and you ski the 35-degree slope, and it doesn't avalanche. And you think, whoa, I made a good decision, but maybe the slope almost avalanched. You don't know. So,
right.
So you got to look more at that decision-making process and not the outcome. Because the outcome may be like, well, the slope didn't avalanche, but the decision-making process, did you use a good process? Did you discuss with your group about the conditions? Did you do tests on the way up? Did you look at red flags? Did you slow down at the top to think about it? Like those sort of things that get involved with the decision-making process.
I like one of the things you talk about in their book is the pre-mortem.
Oh,
what's that?
Yeah, the pre-mortem. Well, who is the Anchorage Daily News writer that used people get avalanche and used to write the article?
Right. Yeah.
I'm forgetting his name. But yeah, in like the 80s and 90s, people get avalanche and then he'd write an article about you, about how dumb you were and how stupid you were and all these mistakes you made and everything. So it's basically you're at the top of a mountain there or top of the ridge and you're going to ski the run. It's like imagining that article, imagining all the things that could go wrong. And then it's like, so it's, it's thinking ahead.
Right.
And then it's thinking ahead. And so it's like, well, maybe, the headlines would have said, you know, they just rushed up there and they ignored the whoomps on the way up. And then they got avalanched. So
they ignored the high danger ranger.
Has
a beautiful sunny powder day. And,
right.
Yeah. And that's classic. We all joke about that, but it's also like, you know, you think about your family and the loved ones that, you know, have to deal with your injured body or your dead body, you know, and that's even the more sort of gut-wrenching pre-mortem. About the consequences of you doing something that affects other people.
Right. Yeah, and that's what I've kind of been wondering about and don't have fully squared away in my mind. But, how that changes through age. You know, when you're in your, like, early 20s and, it's really – it's hard to think about death or anything like that. You're just thinking about it. It's like you got to do it now and now's the time and nothing's going to go wrong and – How could it go wrong? And it's really, so it's just, yeah. So how do you deal with that decision-making through age? It becomes much, much easier the older you get. But, you know, if you're super conservative your whole life, maybe you're not going to get much done.
Let's talk about aging a little bit. You're in your 50s now. How has it changed your decision-making?
Yeah. I'm in my early 50s, and I'm absolutely loving it. I'm just, like, loving the change and learning how to run my body better and doing different things with my body. And then also how with my decision-making and my attitudes in the mountains have really changed a lot. You know, it's, you feel like, you know, I've really gotten my yayas out over the years. I've been able to challenge my stuff, climbing and skiing, you know, so I'm pretty content. So, because I've had that chance and now I'm, you know, shifting gears a little bit where it's like, it's easier to not go on these, steeper faces when, you know, So it's just like, maybe today's not the day. Maybe I won't do it, but I can just wait until another day. I got plenty of those dates left. And
Yeah. Well, and I think physically, too, as we get older, we just can't, you know, go at it as hard.
It's just like slowing down. And, you know, that's been like kind of a topic that I think about a lot with guiding. It's like, I can still keep up with people now, with the clients. You know, a lot of these clients I get, they're really strong and they're really good skiers. You know, they're like super athletes in their 30s, and I can still, I can still do it now, but it's like it's hard, you know. Yeah. I need to take breaks. You know, before it would be like, okay, in spring I'd work every day.
Uh-huh.
And in skiing, it's back under ski guiding and ski mountaineering, and a lot of these trips I'm doing are like week-long trips in the Alaska Range. So it's like come back from a week and it's like I just go straight into the next one. Boom, 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 boom. And now it's like, whoa, I need to take a break because I'm kind of, I kind of get a little tired.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Huh. Do you see, I wonder about people, especially my demographic guys in their 60s, we have a joke about, you know, the have to really go at it in your 60s when you can still do things. Did you see that?
Yeah.
At all?
Oh,
to clients and stuff, or is it like, yeah.
Oh yeah, maybe more for like mountaineering. Yeah, because mountaineering, like, yeah, there's like, because I'm like these two different guiding worlds. Like one is like backcountry skiing in Alaska, and then there's, you know, mountaineering. I'm doing that more in the Alps and in around Chamonix, and some of that, I'm working for a company, and these people, you know, Americans, a lot of them want like Mount Blanc or the Matterhorn. And they're like, okay, they finally have the time and the money.
And they
want to go do these big goals, like, you know, the things, you know, the big mountains.
Yeah.
And so,
Interesting. I think about the Everest client or something like that. They exactly what you're saying. They have the money and the time.
And
it's on their bucket list.
So. Those big, yes. I mean, so, you know, the mountaineering guiding, I struggle with a little bit because, you know, you can be relatively unskilled and climb Everest, be guided up Everest. I mean, it's just like this progression. You take a couple skills, you do a couple mountains and bigger mountains, and then boom, they'll take your money to take you up Everest. But it's just like to go back in your ski in Alaska. Well, first of all, you got to be like a good skier.
Yeah.
And that takes like a lot of time. Most of these people have 5,000, 10,000 hours of skiing in. So they're really talented and they have a lot of appreciation for the mountains, or unlike a lot of, you know, mountaineering clients, they're just, they haven't done a lot. They haven't spent their time out there.
You are listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Paul Tordat. We're talking with Joe Stock, author of the Alaska Factor and the Avalanche Factor. Joe, I want to get back a little bit to this sort of decision-making, and we've taught a very sort of well-used, well-known model is the concept of a triangle. And, you know, in the avalanche world, we have humans, we have terrain, we have snow, we have weather. Talk about sort of what you're thinking about that, and what the and specifically the role of humans in that triangle.
Yeah, it's been really interesting. This spring, in winter, I've been working on updating a field book and trying to figure out what people can use and what avalanche schools can use. And interesting, so I've been rethinking a lot of this stuff, and you know, it's kind of going back around to my thinking's going back around to this avalanche triangle that Jill Fredson and Doug Fessler came up with like back in the 80s or 90s. And it's, you know, it's just a way of structuring the information where it's like terrain, weather, and snowpack are on the outside, and in the middle they have people. But you know, I've been kind of more thinking about this. It's like, you know, the idea that I can't shake is like, well, there's the conditions. Conditions dictate the terrain you're going to go on. So it's like the condition of the weather, condition of the snowpack, and the condition of the people. Based on those three things, you're going to choose the terrain. And so for me, it's just like, well, terrain's in the middle. That's like the foundation of the whole thing. Because people are just as like unwieldy as weather and snowpack. So it's like understanding those
and
three conditions.
And sometimes as unpredictable.
Yeah. It's like, well, they're even, maybe even more unpredictable than the weather and snowpack. So it's like, well, let's just, the real focus here is the terrain. And the terrain, it's like those factors of terrain traps, slopes over 30 degrees, and then being in the run out of slopes over 30 degrees.
Huh, interesting. And in the people, I'm interested also, you were talking in the book about Maslow's hierarchy and sort of that, you know, we talk about Maslow and most people are familiar with it, but sort of having the basic needs of food and shelter and, you know, psychological safety and so forth, sort of leading up to sort of a peak experience of sorts.
Yeah.
Talk about that and that its influence on decision making.
Yeah. So, in Maslow's, you need the food, shelter, and that physical safety there before. Those core things before we can actually think about safety like avalanche stuff. So. We need to win the backcountry, so that's why it makes it important to take a lot of food when you're in the backcountry. Just have like a big sack of food so you don't run out of food, because as soon as you run out of food, it's like, it's really hard to think. And then taking shelter. Always have a shelter in your backpack. You know, you can just bring one of these little $15 space blanket things from REI. You can get one of those and have that live in your backpack. So you got to have those.
Yeah.
And enough clothing for, you know, so you're warm. So, yeah. a big puffy coat in your backpack. Even if you don't plan on using it, bring in that puffy coat so you're warm, have lots of food, and so you can think right. And then that helps with the decision making.
Yeah, yeah.
Better.
And you talk about how when you don't have those things, how does that affect your decision making?
Yeah, it's just really, it's hard to think right when you're cold, wet, hungry. It's just like you're just thinking you want to get back to the barn. You want to get back to the car and get home. So you're going to start taking shortcuts, not slow down to talk with your partners and just start taking the shortcuts. And that's, you know, we've probably all experienced that, but it's you can help avoid that by taking a lot of food, extra clothing, and being comfortable and taking breaks so you can eat and drink and talk with your partners.
I find that very, very, very fundamental. When I'm hungry and I'm tired, I tend to get grumpy and not make the right decisions. Sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah.
I also want to talk, and as far as decision making, a couple things before we finish up here. What role we talked about consensus, right? And that role of consensus in a group.
Uh-huh.
And now you're a guide, and so I assume when you're a guide, you're in charge and you're sort of making those decisions.
Uh-huh.
Like, how does that work when you're out with friends? Like, how does consensus work, and how are those decisions made with a group of friends?
Right. Yeah, this is a really fascinating topic that I don't have fully squared away in my mind, but I'm kind of really more interested in it now, partly because of writing this article about the science and avalanches. Because in science, you believe stuff. Well, you don't know the truth, but you can believe it when there's scientific consensus. The scientific consensus is that humans are causing climate change because of the greenhouse emissions. But so that's why we believe it, because there's this scientific consensus. But then I was like, well, you know, some people say, well, we need consensus in decision making in the backcountry. Like one of the avalanche education providers that's popular in the lower 48 is ARRI, and they say in their field book, they say decide by consensus. And I was like, consensus? And I was like, what does that even mean? And I was trying to look into it, and how does it relate over? And it's like, I'm not really sure, because, it's like, well, some person, there's the devil's advocate that doesn't want to ski the slope. And then, so it's like, well, the consensus has to go with that person. And then, well, if you're really going to decide and all come to an agreement, then you're going to be stalled out there for hours and hours and hours debating everything.
Yeah.
It is like, so at some point it's like, well, maybe having like, you know, a leader make some sort of, or some sort of authoritative person in the group make a decision. And I feel really, this is a skill I'm really bad at, because I'm mostly guiding, you know, I'm talking with all the clients, and because they have a lot of knowledge, and I'm asking them questions and you know, and I'm listening to them, but it's like, ultimately I'm making the decision. You know, if I don't feel like doing that, I'm not going to do it.
Yeah.
So I feel like it's a skill I'm really poor at, and I'm kind of want to learn more about this consensus.
But do you, if you're in a situation, and there's some case studies with this, if you have a group and you have, and you're thinking, well, I'm feeling pretty good about this, but you have a client that's like, no, I'm adamant that I'm not going to do this. How do you deal with that?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, that's easy. Yeah. If they don't want to do it, or if they, even if they, you know, I'm really tuning into what they say, if they're hesitant about something, I mean, I'm going with that. If they're like, I'm not sure about this, then I'm like honing red on that, and we're not going to do it.
Yeah.
If they're, so those things that are those, if they have safety concerns like that, I'm going to hone right in with that and go to the side of caution.
Yeah. One of the great lessons I had early on in my outdoor career was having to make being with other very experienced instructors. This was with the National Outdoor Leadership School, and it was in a kayak and ocean environment, but very, very dynamic, very a lot of unknowns there, as is in with the avalanche world. And we had a big decision to make that had big consequences if we were wrong. And these guys had decades of experience, and I was like year one, not quite year one, but almost. And they both looked at me without saying anything, and they said, "What do you think?" And I was like, "Oh no, let's not go." And that was the right decision, but it taught me to always be thinking for myself in a group.
Right.
Like, oh, even if I have someone with more experience, I'm always processing and thinking about, you know, being my own avalanche forecaster. People like talking about that, being my own head of guide, and thinking mm-hmm. about learning, from more experienced people or even less experienced people, because they might have seen something I didn't see. They might have heard a big whoomp that I didn't hear, or seen an avalanche that I didn't see. Having that discussion is really important.
Yeah, speaking up, so like everybody is heard. Everybody in the members heard, and I say that to with clients. It's like, speak up. I mean, if you're concerned about something, you have to speak up, because that's part of being a team and working together. Because you got to remember about myself as the guide. It's like, I'm just an emotional human that really, really, really likes to ski. So speak up if you're concerned about something, because, I make a lot of really dumb decisions. So keep that in mind.
Yeah. Well, that's right. And listen to other people, right?
Listening
is a really very important communication skill. Well, Joe, thank you very much for joining me today. This is Outdoor Explorer. I want to thank Joe Stock for being on the show with me. Joe, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you. It's been so much fun hanging out with you and talking, Paul.
Yep. And we'll have a link to Joe's books on the Outdoor Explorer website. Thanks to my guest, Joe Stock. Also thanks to our producer, Tobin Shelby, with additional help from Armin Swenson. I'm your host, Paul Twardock, and from all the hosts at Outdoor Explorer, stay safe and we'll see you outdoors.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and in your favorite podcast app. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.